Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a golden glimmer in the stream that is arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we celebrate and reflect the life and work of Nick Drake as the fateful gather once more. We call in on Max Houseband Switch and go back to where this show began, catching up on their sound and ambitions prior to their Sunset Arena performance at the end of last month. And we get lost in the murky world of unsolved murder as an innovative theatre production helps us work out what happened to Fred Jeffs. If you would like more information on the show, its archive, or to get in touch, you can find us at www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start the show with some snapshots of last weekend's Nick Drake gathering, an annual celebration of one of England's greatest songwriting enigmas. Now in its 15th year, and reflecting on what would have been his 70th birthday year, I started by talking to key organiser, Philip Littleford.
We are in the Church of Mary Magdalene, here in Tamworth in Arden, in leafy rural Warwickshire. I know where I am, which is always a good start. And Philip is one of the, I guess, one of the organisers, but more than that, of the Nick Drake gathering. And Philip, we were just saying that you've been described really as the kind of one of the grandparents of the festival. It's more of a, I guess, more of a celebration than a festival.
It is.
Should we start with what the gathering is?
Yes, I think those fans who increasingly attend the gathering are conscious of the fact that nobody wanted to celebrate Nick's death. His birth might have been an alternative, but somehow something in between lent itself supremely to having a get-together in the summer. The green, as you say, green leafy areas in which he lived for some of his life. And this has been perpetuated now for some 14 years has an increasing number of followers from all over the world, one has to say, but at a level which can be accommodated by the village. The numbers aren't huge. They demonstrate an appreciation of Nick's work and his music, and many of the visitors are themselves singer-songwriters who enjoy trying in a small way to emulate what he achieved.
I think a gathering is a good word as well, because there's a very, from what I've read just before coming to meet you, there's an intimate focus of the event. And it's not a kind of full-blown rock festival kind of mass, sort of audience event. It is very much focused on celebrating his work. And, I guess the sort of positivity of his work.
Yeah. I think positivity, yes, but I think people would say that hidden within it, parts of evidence of maybe a troubled mind, a sadness that I think at the base of it, when although his composing was well received, the fact that he, for example, necessitated changing the tuning of his guitar for individual songs started to hamper his ability to perform on stage, and therefore his appreciation of his work didn't materialise at the time and expand as it could have done. And it's only over the years, in its recorded form, that that appreciation has developed. People, as I say, who increasingly have become having an understanding of his work, in particular the lyrics. I mean, if one compares it with modern day pop music, you find songs that are thought to be very good contain just a continual repeat of one line of lyric. There's no poetry in it at all, whereas in I think one would have to say that Nick's lyrics are poetical.
There's an air of, I've been a big fan of Nick Drake for a long time, and there's an air of kind of mystery, if you like, about his music, and a kind of almost, you know, that, to use that word again, there's a kind of magical aspect to it. How much of that do you think is kind of reflects the village and the kind of setting that he that he sort of hadn't spent time in?
That's difficult to say, because, to be fair, in that his 27 years, very relatively few of those years were spent in the village, because he was born in the Far East, where his father worked. When they came back to this country, fairly soon he was sent off to boarding school at Marlborough, and then went to Cambridge.
So in terms of Nick Drake as a musician, as an artist, he is someone that endures, and I think people perhaps discovered his talent late, or maybe people say too late, if you like, but certainly in the last 20, 25 years I've been listening to his music, he's an enduring figure. Well, why do you think he is such a positive and a sort of enduring influence?
I think because I use the word poetry. Good poetical music has an enduring life, whereas a modern song may be good for a fortnight, but then is forgotten. And I think that says it all, really. And the fact that, going back to his musical ability, his guitar playing, that fascinates people as well. For budding guitarists, represents a challenge. It isn't just a strumming exercise. There is, you know, serious talent in his guitar playing as well.
I know a number of people who play guitar and have said to me that, you know, Nick Drake's style and the sort of variations he used song to song is very difficult to copy or to even.
I mean, not that I'm an expert, but it's interesting that over the weekend we find that there are an increasing number of people, again, of visitors from over the world who've really studied it and developed the ability to play his music, much to their satisfaction and people who listen to them, and that perpetuates the appreciation that that continues to build.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of structure, if you like, of the gathering.
Right.
Because it's over a couple of days. People gather and enjoy themselves and enjoy the music. But the days are different, aren't they? They do different things.
Yes. Principally, there are 2 days. People normally start to dribble in on Thursday, but Friday, those visitors that are camping, most of them are camping, will assemble in the village hall for a get-together, meeting old friends. Very much it's that sort of atmosphere, and that gives the opportunity, that evening in the village hall, opportunity for people who haven't been before, who'd like to express themselves and be given the opportunity to test their own ability to a receptive audience who are very sympathetic, even to relative beginners. It's a mixed gathering, but it's well received, and it's a pleasant evening. And then that is followed by a pre-selected number of established players of Nick's music. In the main, singer-songwriters who play, who are guitarists, one or two of the Nick Drake songs are performed by other groups, slightly larger groups, who enjoyed the experiment of playing Nick's music in that format, and that works as a contrast to just pure guitar-based music, and that attracts probably as many as 200 people. That's on the Saturday afternoon. And feels that that's held in the church, and is well received by everybody. We don't sell tickets, and people can wander in, wander out. All we ask for are donations to cover the costs involved in the whole weekend. But increasingly, you know, appreciate it, and then most people clearly will stay over on Saturday evening after that event. So there's still a lot of camaraderie on the Sunday morning. And in fact, just to coincide with the weekend this year, our organist in the church, who also is director of music for the choir here, was approached by a German children's choir who she'd met before in Germany, taken her choir from Northfield in Birmingham on a trip. They were they're in this country. And in fact, on the Sunday afternoon this year, there's going to be a concert of three choirs. In fact, the German Children's Choir, Tamworth's own church choir, and also the Director of Music's own choir. And so that adds something else to
it. Wow, quite a, yeah. Quite a combination.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to just finally ask was, in terms of the songs and the music, right. Over those, say, 14, 15 years the gathering has been happening, I'm guessing there are songs that keep coming out that people want to play or people demand to play, and I'm sure there's a bit of negotiation as to who plays what.
Yes.
But what kind of songs come out? Which ones do people respond to most?
I think for me, Riverman.
One of the songs that I've heard covered most,
Interestingly,
is Black Eyed Dog.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Whilst not moving too far away from the original version, it's interesting to see what different slight variations various performers can put on those songs without destroying them altogether, really.
Excellent. And we were trying to work out earlier on, I think, that it would have been, I think, Nick's 70th birthday this year?
Yes, only 2 or 3 weeks ago.
I'm going to try and come along to the gathering and talk to some of the folks who are doing the gathering.
You'd be very welcome.
Thank you. But for now, Philip, thanks for taking time to talk to me.
Right, pleasure.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
So I'm with Hawken. We're here at the kind of, I suppose, the prelude to the Nick Drake gathering. And you've just performed a couple of songs, Nick Drake songs.
Yeah.
And tell us about your connection to Nick Drake, what he means to you.
Actually, I think I've been listening to Nick Drake for about 12, 13 years. A friend of mine introduced that music to me, who had a record shop in my hometown. And I really liked it. I bought his three records then, and I bought a songbook with all the lyrics and the chords, and I started to tune, and it was something different for me. It's like playing guitar for the first time again. I learned a lot of Nick Drake songs, and I've been here now for the sixth time. Sixth year in a row.
And is he big in Norway? Is he have a following, or is he?
He's getting bigger. I guess for 10 years ago, nobody had heard of Nick Drake. Actually, it's more popular now.
So the songs that you performed, there were two, I think.
It was.
Tell me about those. Why you chose those?
It was Northern Sky, and I actually connected it with some notes from Pink Moon into Place to Be. Actually, because it's they're not too difficult to play, so when I'm here, I relax a bit more than if I should play the more difficult songs. And I like Northern Sky because it's a new musical express. The music papers voted it once to be the greatest love song ever in history.
It's a good one to choose, isn't it?
Yeah.
And just finally, why do you think Nick's music endures? Why do you think it lasts so long?
I think it's the lyrics and his voice, and it's something special. He didn't sound like anyone else, and the history, I think it's fascinating. And to come here in Tanworth in Arden, see his house where he lived, see the grave and everything. It's fascinating. And he was 26 years old, and people didn't appreciate him when he was alive, and his records didn't sell much. And it's fascinating how popular he has been now, 40 years. after.
I'll let you get back to your Guinness in the rain.
Good.
And I really enjoyed your performance, so thanks very much.
Thank you.
So I'm with Peter Rice. You have a kind of technical connection, don't you, in some ways, to Nick Drake?
Well, I knew Nick at university. Although he was in a different college from me, he did a performance through another friend, and so I was the head of the Tape Recording Society at the time, and I was invited in to record him, and that went quite well. That was, in fact, his first public performance, and as far as I know, it's the only recording now that exists still of Nick performing publicly. That was really how I got to know him, and then he asked me to do the demo recordings for what turned out to be his recording contract, and so I eventually found a space where we could do that in some college rooms, and sent that tape off. And as far as I know, it was that that got him his recording contract with the record company.
Wow, so you have a real place in history, I think, really, in terms of a small part maybe, but an important one, I think.
Yes, I think it probably would have happened anyway, but I happened to facilitate that moment, so that was quite interesting.
So one of the things I read most about Nick Drake is that he never really performed live. He was very sort of, I think, shy or perhaps reticent to take some of the songs out to an audience. So
it depends depends what you mean by perform. He did, because he wanted to publicise the LP that he'd produced, and Joe Boyd insisted that he tour to what turned out to be very inappropriate venues. I went to see him at the Royal Festival Hall, where he was supporting Fairport Convention. That actually was quite good, because it was an attentive, appreciative audience, and so he was not having a problem there. But in the other venues he went to, Northern clubs and so on, people just went on talking while he was tuning and performing, and then they threw things at him, and he really didn't like that.
So let's talk about The Gathering and how you sort of got involved in that, because you're sort of, in a nice way, you're kind of part of the establishment, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. It came about through Denise, because she was took it over from the event that happened in 2003, and then in 2004 she wanted to bring it together in here as a wider appreciative audience, and I got invited to come along to do the sound, and because I knew Nick, I knew how people should play and how they performed, and so I was lucky enough to be the sound engineer right from 2004. So we've done it every year since. I owe it to him. He was a very good performer, and he was an interesting man as a friend. He was one who had a lot of pigeonholes for different people. You'd occupy a few hours of his time, and then he'd disappear, and then you'd see him again, and it's as though that gap in which he disappeared never happened. So he was very good at switching between groups of friends. He never really got over the fact that his LPs didn't sell very well, and as you probably know, they've sold much more since the advertisement for the Volkswagen in the States. That's what really triggered his resurgence of sales in the US, and also it was probably that he was ahead of his time. There was people wanting heavy rock and whatever was else around at the time, and Nick didn't fit into that pattern, so it's very good that his music is appreciated these days.
How would he look at the music business today, do you think?
The whole business he'd be ashamed of, but his success, he'd be amazed and embarrassed, because he's achieving now what he never achieved in his lifetime. And no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't do it. And that is a sad thing, but it's good that it has come about.
For more information on The Gathering, the performers and future plans, go to nickdrakegathering.wixsite.com/NDG official. Or check out their Facebook page. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. Now to Switch Sunset, an evening of live music and performance from Mac Makes Music's project band, Switch. With a few new characters, some great new songs, I went back to rehearsals after a while away
to talk to the band as they geared up for their main summer performance.
Right, so amazingly, it's 2 years ago I came and met with Switch and had a chat with folks, and there's a bit of a lineup change since.
That's
some
right.
New members. Should we do a quick introduction, go around and do some names?
Hi, I'm Nishita.
I'm Azim.
Hi, I'm San.
I'm Gurpreet.
Hi, I'm Ryan.
Got most, I think, of the band members. Is that right? There's no one missing?
There are two more members we missed out. One, we got a new member named Eve, and one is Carl.
Carl on the guitar.
Yes.
So, so you've got a big concert coming up.
That's right.
Yep. Next Friday, is
next
that right?
Friday. Yeah,
next Friday.
Yes,
10
days left.
Next Friday, 29th of June.
So let's catch up with folks. How are you feeling about that, Nishita? How are you feeling about that?
I'm excited and a bit nervous.
The usual mix. Is that how you feel before gigs usually?
Yeah.
Now you've done a few gigs as well, haven't you? I've seen you perform two or three times.
Yeah.
So you've got quite a lot of practice in, which is good.
I remember the last time we saw each other was on 27th of July last year for the NHS.
That's right. There was a big event, wasn't there, at the MAC, which was very well received. Everyone since that event asks me how Switch are doing, how Switch the band are doing. So I think you made an impact on people. Now, there's a new rap vocal element, or a more rap vocal element this time around.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Tell us a bit about that, because that's a slightly different departure, I guess.
Well, I do a lot of raps, and I sing. Mostly I do raps for the school. I did it for a play once. Gigs and stuff like that, I feel very confident because I did it before, a few years ago. I used to be in a band as well when I was a kid. I think I was 5 years old. I used to rap. I used to be nervous then, a lot nervous. But when I got in the new band, I feel very confident because I got very used to this because I do a lot of plays. I act a lot, like in roles. I play different roles.
Let's ask Ryan. Ryan, you've kind of brought a bit of a new sound to Switch, I think. I don't know if we had much kind of synth before or kind of a string synth sound. How have you got involved?
I got through my school. Me and Guthrie go to the same school, but we got involved by a teacher who knew about the band, and he introduced us to the band a couple of years ago.
Excellent. And everyone seems to be very kind of, you know, working well together. There's a bit of a vibe, I think, which is good. When you come into rehearsal, you never know quite what to expect. You know, kind of creative types do get a bit passionate sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, especially when it comes to ideas, we all agree as a band, but sometimes we have disagreements between the band, and sometimes we agree on the ideas, or sometimes if one of the members get off topic, which is kind of like disrespect to the band. But all I'm trying to do as my role of the as Switch, because I've been this almost 5 years, try to get the band together and always show them in a respect manner and be like the role models.
Excellent. And Gurpreet, you've taken to the drums, I've noticed.
Yep.
And how easy is that? They often say drummers are the kind of key person in a band because they let everybody know what's happening, what speed, but also they let everyone know when there's a break. That's really important, I think, as in a lunch or a tea break.
Yeah.
So how have you found taking up the drums?
Yeah, quite nice. Like, it's quite easy. Like, I'm really confident. Really nice. Yeah.
Excellent. You're sounding very good in rehearsals. Let's talk a little bit about some of the new songs that you've come up with. You've got some old favourites, I think, but there's some new material.
We got a new song called "Garage Is the Key to Paradise," and it sounds like a catchy.
It's a song that is that shows respect towards the old garage and hip hop artists like Soul Solly Crew and like etc. Plus, I got the idea from a remix of two tunes. One, "When the Bass Line Drops" by Craig David, and "Closer" by the Chainsmokers. Plus, another new song called "Birmingham Needs You," and that's about Birmingham and all the sites in Birmingham and the surroundings around Birmingham. And I got that tune, and we made that tune from a tune from a hip hop band called Lotto Boys called "Birmingham Anthem."
Yeah, there's another song that we also did which is new. It's called Switchery, and it's basically a song about who switches and what we do, and it shows an introduction to who we are as well.
We got that from the conference that we just did about a couple of months ago.
Yeah. 3 months.
Excellent. And how about performing the songs? Are there things you've been working on in terms of
improving the songs that we're working on, especially old and new?
We've been working on them, trying to get them smooth and perform really nicely so there's no mistakes in them. So we've been practicing over and over again on each tune.
And when you perform the songs, do they change each time? From sort of performance to performance? Are there things you add in?
I would say they improve a lot. So since we got new members, myself and Eve, we created some new raps. Well, I created some new raps, and Eve created a new solo, like a new guitarist solo. So then it improves the music, and improves the song. And it makes it like really nice. It makes it improved. It.
Bright lights, big buildings, boring and loads of books. It's a brand new place. Brave hearts, bold logos, big chances where we eat. It's amazing grace.
Birmingham, me too, Birmingham, me too. We are young and talented people.
Reunite botanical gardens, a tropical Birmingham Blues Football Club, Blackwell Adventure Park. Some of these places are peaceful, some of these places are crowded, some of these places are brilliant, so we can play it loud.
Birmingham needs you, Birmingham needs you. We are young and talented people. Birmingham needs you, Birmingham needs you. This is a Hollywood experience.
Birmingham, Birmingham, places to be. Always chilling in Star City. Bollywood movies on the high sea. Eating popcorn, drinking drinks. Nachos, Nando's, places to eat. Loads of hotels, places to sleep. All you have, all you need. Right here in Birmingham City.
Okay, so I'm with Holly Radford, who's the producer of Mac Makes Music, which means, Holly, I think that you look after Switch, the band,
yep,
and lots of other things as well. But let's start with Switch and Mac Makes Music, because it was 2 years ago, I think, I first became aware of the project and of switch. Mm-hmm. And things have progressed, I think, slightly since then. There's some new faces. You're a new face as well. So where are we with Mac Makes Music?
Well, Mac Makes Music has just started the next four-year youth music grant. So that will take us up to 2022. So we're a fundee again, which means we are now part of Youth Music's Alliance for a Musically Inclusive England, which is what the group of 13 organisations across the country is called. And we're going to be focusing on three different strands. So two main strands, which are special educational needs and disability and social, emotional, mental health. And with a smaller strand, focus around early years, but with sort of workforce development and a bit of research there.
And MAC is kind of centering itself, isn't it, focusing itself as a kind of, I guess, as a support hub for some of these things.
So I think MAC, the Midlands Arts Centre's business plan, has some priority areas with children and young people, so looking at our engagement with families, schools, higher education groups, and then also sort of disability arts specialism, looking at how we commission disabled artists, how we work with groups who lead in that area, and also children and young people, really, in terms of a focus with technology is one thing that we're looking at, so how we can engage children with a digital offer, but yes, there's lots of different priority areas.
And Switch themselves as a band have had a bit of a lineup change. They've got some new people, some new energy, should we say, which is great. And I, you know, sitting around their rehearsals earlier, there is an energy in the room, which is great. There's a chemistry. How, you know, like most bands, I suppose it's difficult, isn't it, when you bring in new people? How have they kind of sort of coped with that? How have they progressed themselves with that?
Well, it's definitely a unique dynamic, I think. And like you say, it's a small group of lots of different, very individual people who all bring different things to the table. And we have had a couple of members come and go who've come and tried things out and decided it's not quite for them. That's particularly been a few members on the autistic spectrum who really prefer to do their own individual music making and have wanted to try the group stuff but have maybe decided it's not quite for them where they're at in their sort of musical development. But the members kind of come about through word of mouth, through our contacts within special schools. Really, it's sort of a referral process and people come and try it out and just see how they get on. So it's quite organic, really, I think.
And obviously the rehearsals and the practice are the important bits, because you're kind of, you know, polishing the kind of final product, as it were. How important are the events and the concerts, do you think, in terms of the programme? Kind of a key part to it?
I think they're really key. I think for Switch as a band, it's great for them to be able to showcase what they've been doing. All the lyric writing, the content is all led by them, with our music leaders just supporting and empowering them to be able to lead things in the direction they want to go in, which is a sort of belief that underpins the whole of the Mac Makes Music programme, so child-centred, creative music-making approach. I think they're kind of getting to the point now where we're seeing them as ambassadors for other groups. So an example would be the Warriors are supporting them at their gig that's coming up, and they're a band that were originally set up at a special school, and they still rehearse there now over in Sandwell. But Switch, kind of, they did a few gigs and they've been supporting Switch, and gradually, you know, they're coming on. But I think getting out there, showcasing what they're doing, what they're capable of, because it's really brilliant, I think is great in terms of advocating, you know, young people with disabilities making music.
I think the other great thing about it is it's very locally focused, has a real local connection, you know, it has a real Birmingham edge to it, which I think is great. And they've got a concert coming up here at the Mac next Friday, a big concert. They've got other bigger things as well. They've got a big venue in London, which I think we should clarify which venue that is in London coming up. And that's later on, I think, is that July time?
Yeah, so that's the week after, so they don't have much break. But yeah, so that's at the Albany in Deptford in London, and that's a company called Heart and Soul have been organising this event called the Squids Club, which is an annual event. So that Switch have been invited to go along to that, which is great. But they've been doing quite a lot of high profile gigs. So they did, they performed last year for Music for Youth in Birmingham, which was great. They performed and led some breakout sessions for our conference that we did back in March. That was them basically training teachers and music leaders, which was fab, because that's a really sort of different way of coming at things, I think, for the, you know, workforce development. And they performed there and really enjoyed that as well. So there's lots of different things they've been up to.
Excellent. And just for folks listening, where would folks find out more about Switch and Mac Makes Music? And importantly, if someone's out there thinking, I know someone that would really be great, you know, connected to Switch or connected to that programme, where could they look?
I just think on the Mac website, we're under the projects area, but if you just typed in Mac Makes Music on Google, for example, you'd be able to find us. We do have a channel on YouTube, and it's mainly got videos of Switch and the Warriors, so that'd be a good place to have a look if you want to see some more of Switch performing.
Okay, excellent. For now, Holly, we'll give the drums a rest as well. You can hear the drums in the background, but for now, Holly, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Be ready to rock on.
Now, just finally, just to finish, I don't want to keep you from your valuable rehearsal time. Practice makes perfect.
Yeah,
I've learned that over time. In terms of folks listening to the podcast and to the radio, if they're interested in sort of taking up music, getting involved in music, what advice would you give them, given, you know, you've sort of had some experience in it now? What has music given you that you think perhaps other people might...
I think they should take the dream and take the opportunity to join a band or create music, because it improves yourself. Like, if you can't play any time or you're not like the greatest like, the instrument that you play, you will improve over time in a band or... through the music idea that you want to go down.
Well, if they've got a computer, I think they should download GarageBand or Logic Pro.
Something easy just to sort of get them started.
Get the inspiration to music, because if your hopes and dreams are your life and you need to go through that route.
If you want to be a musician, rapper or singer, I suggest being a band, or you can do like after school clubs, and then they will teach you and do band sessions on how to improve in the guitar or a certain instrument that you need to focus on.
Excellent. Well, I'm coming along to the gig next week, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to talk to you before the gig, excitingly, backstage,
Makes sense.
To get a feel for how you are before and after, maybe. But,
Of course.
Looks like Switch might be back for a next podcast after 2 years.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll try and do it more frequently than 2 years. But for now, thanks very much, and I'll let you get back to rehearsing.
Thank you.
We are gonna perform our last song of the evening, which is New Beginnings featuring The Warriors, and hope you guys enjoy it.
You can find an extended podcast version of this interview with more of the band's tracks at www.kingofthebuttons.co.uk and more information on the project at macbirmingham.co.uk. And finally, to murder. A cold case from more than 60 years ago, to be exact. I caught up with writer and performer Graham Rose at Smethwick's Thimble Mill Library for an evening of interactive sleuthing and exploration of the mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of his great-uncle. So I'm with Graham Rose, and I've just seen a performance of Fred Jeff's The Sweet Shop Murder. I'll get that right.
Yep, that's the show.
I have to say, Graham, it was absolutely fascinating. And I think fascinating on a number of levels. One is, it wasn't just a murder story, it was a real mystery and intrigue, but also how you'd kind of portrayed it and found out more about it with using a very local canvas. So let's start with that by just giving folks a bit of a picture. So folks listening will probably not know who Fred Jeffs was or is.
Yeah, Fred Jeffs was the owner of a Quinton sweet shop. And on Maundy Thursday, 1957, he was brutally murdered. And what I am doing with this, I should point out initially that I'm the great nephew of Fred Jeff, so I'm related. So this is a family story, and I thought it was a skeleton in the cupboard, so to speak. But I was really curious about whether other people in the local area, in the Quinton and Whalley areas, might know about this story. And I've been sitting on this story for so long, about 30 years, and I thought, well, if I'm going to do anything about it, I need to do it now, really, because anybody who has any living memory of the 18th of April 1957 will be getting on a bit. You know, they're in their late 60s or 70s or 80s. So I approached the Birmingham Rep and their Furnace programme, which is a community engagement programme, with the idea of spreading the idea across the community and trying to find people who had a memory. And what I've been doing is I've been collecting interviews with people who were in the shop on the day or who remember the case, if not first-hand, then second-hand, because their parents talked about the case. And using all this information, I've been trying to reopen the investigation into the unsolved crime of Fred Jeff's murder.
And it's remarkable that it is unsolved still, and you are doing a bit of sleuthing and gradually finding out bits as you go. And I think one of the things that strikes me is that, sadly, I guess murder now is kind of commonplace, you know, it's kind of something that we're perhaps desensitised to. And this project helps, I think, bring context to tell us something about society back 60 years ago as much as anything.
Well, there are lots of people who say, or come up with the same little phrases, one of which is, oh, you know, back then, murder hardly ever happened. You never heard about it. These days, you read about it every day. And I was curious about that, actually. So, I mean, looking back at the old press publications, the Smethwick Telephone or the Birmingham Post or whatever from 1957, and I realised, actually, it was a violent place. There was lots of violent things going on. There were violent robberies. The whole generation of people had come back from the war, they brought weapons with them, there was black market happening, you know, there were austere times. And so there was crime, but it was less, perhaps less visible. And there was this desire during the 50s to just kind of muck through, and particularly for younger ones, they didn't hear about it because their parents didn't talk about it. And there was a real hush-hush, there was a real cover-up over darker elements. And that's what I've really discovered with this, is that my grandparents didn't tell my dad or my auntie anything. I mean, they hardly knew anything about Fred Jeff's murder, and he was their uncle, you know. Things were brushed under the carpet. And so this is an opportunity to kind of open up that conversation with that generation.
Now, you said something really interesting, I think, at the start of the performance, of the show, as it were, about people's identities, their personalities being made up of facts and figures from the community and stories and ideas that people have about individuals. Now, I think that the resonance of that is really sort of magnified by the fact that, again, you said you didn't know your great-uncle because obviously you weren't born, you know, in his lifetime. So tell us a little bit about, I guess, this approach, because it's a really interesting way to build a picture.
Well, I've, as a theatre maker, I've always been interested in a kind of monumental work, in a way, about what it is to mark somebody's life or describe somebody's life. And I find this quite an intriguing challenge, really, that we have this romanticised view of a person as this kind of self-sufficient entity, but we know different, the reality of life. That idea is promoted through Hollywood, you know, the lone man who's, you know, the Tom Cruise figure who just is prepared to save the universe. But the reality of life is totally different. We're part of a network of connections with family and friends and sometimes adversaries. And so with the Fred Jeffs, I'm interested to find out who this person is. And you ask one person, you get one opinion. You ask a second person, you might get a little bit of overlap, but you get a totally different picture. And a person is this amalgam of different perspectives and thoughts and impressions. And that's what I've hoped to kind of collate here with this show.
Now, some of your cast, as it were directly impacted by this mystery or this murder or things surrounding it. So Alan, for example, I think I think he found the murder weapon, which, and you could tell when he relayed some of that information, it still haunted him.
Yeah, yeah. in creating a little community of people who are invested in this project, we also stumbled across people who were directly involved and remember firsthand events from the time. And Alan Waugh is a lovely fellow who I'm so thrilled to have met, because when you talk to Alan, when you talk to his brother, you are accessing the memory of a nine-year-old in the body of, you know, a 70-year-old, really, because that memory for him has just been frozen in time. And he was walking along Samuel Valley, the Wasson, when he stumbled across this object, which was covered in blood and gore, and he threw it, he got rid of it. And at the same time, he realised he was being followed, tracked by somebody who he describes as looking like a gangster. When the police took him back to review the location and try and rediscover that weapon, I mean, Alan had no idea what it was at the time. There were no traces. It had disappeared. And so, in his mind, he holds the responsibility for this story, for something that was never found. And part of his memory has wondered whether it was all a fabrication. Was it real? Was it all a dream? How can it exist if the murder weapon doesn't exist? So this project is, in a way, it's about reconstructing some of those events and making them real again.
Now, just finally, it seems strange to us, sitting in the information age, as we call it, that really a lot of the detail, a lot of the kind of hard evidence, as it were, doesn't exist anymore. It's kind of disappeared. You were saying, I think, at the end of the show, that a number of kind of sort of files and reports have disappeared. You know, the police don't hold them anymore.
Yeah, we put in a request to access any documentation or evidence on file, and as it's a cold case, 61 years old, unsolved murder, then it was reasonable to suppose that there would still be something on file. But when information got back to us that there was nothing on file, we have to kind of draw the line there. So the police at the moment are kind of drawing a blank, and that raises lots of questions. Obviously, it raises questions about how long that material did exist for, whether there was a willful, you know, decision to sideline the investigation for whatever reason, or whether it was just taking up too much space in an archive room. But obviously the West Midlands Police didn't exist in 1957. It brought together lots of different forces, so that complicates the kind of administrative history of this case.
Now, this is a cold case, and I think you've done well to sort of cast some light and some warmth onto it, if you like. What happens next in terms of, you know, after the performances? Are you pursuing the case still? Is it a life's work for you now? Or?
I feel like we've only just scratched the surface with this. I really do. The fact that it's still and remains unsolved is only a carrot and an opportunity to investigate further. In the course of doing this research, and I should say that, you know, what you've just seen in the last hour is a tiny fraction of the amount of material and stories that have been uncovered. There are so many different opportunities to investigate further, different avenues and theories, that I feel that it's really rich pickings, and I'm going to make sure that I continue to create another iteration of this.
So if there's someone listening to this show who thinks, well, hold on a minute, I remember that sweet shop and I remember that dark figure in the doorway, where should they go? How should they get in touch? Is there a place they can
go?
Well,
this has been produced through the Furness programme at the Birmingham Rep. So you can, if you're online, you can Google Furness and my name's Graham Rose. And the Sweet Shop Murder, Fred Jeffs, the Sweet Shop Murder. If you can Google that, you can find my details there. And please get in touch if you have any interesting information to add to this expanding investigation.
Well, excellent, Graham. I really enjoyed the show, and it's great to get a chance to talk to you. And thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Fred Jeffs, the Sweet Shop Murder, was created as part of the Furness Programme through the Birmingham Rep. For more information, go to birmingham-rep.co.uk. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Holly Radford, Dan Whitehouse and Mac Birmingham, the members of Switch and the Warriors, Philip Littleford, Peter Rice and all at the Nick Drake Gathering, Graham Rose, the Furness Project, staff at Thimblemill Library and the Rep Birmingham. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 FM Switch Radio.